The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
I help people every day to improve their health. Sometimes they've had lifelong issues or not fully recovered after a stressful event. The doctors have often run out of ideas. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session. For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
Hello, welcome to the Yes to Life show. If you're a regular listener, welcome back and thanks for your interest and continued support. If you're new here, I hope you enjoy the show and will want to join those regulars. I'm Robin Daly, the founder of Yes to Life, the UK charity this show is named after. The charity and this show focus exclusively on integrative medicine for cancer, or integrative oncology as it's more exactly called. The integrative approach includes the state of a person's body, their mind and their spirit when looking for ways to improve their well-being. So as you can imagine, there are many disciplines that come under the umbrella of integrative oncology. This week, my guest is Gemma Holding. Gemma is CEO of Cancer Support UK, and I met her at a public policy exchange conference recently where I shared the platform with her. We were looking into achieving world-class cancer outcomes, assessing the 2015 cancer strategy and planning for the future, a big agenda. I was very impressed by Gemma's focused approach to developing the mission of Cancer Support UK and by their efforts to address a massive gap in cancer care. I'm talking to Gemma over the phone. Hi Gemma, many thanks for joining us on the Yes to Life show today.
Hi Robin, thanks for having me.
So there's a few enormous cancer charities and a mountain of smaller ones out there. They're all attracting funds and working away to tackle some aspect of cancer or cancer care. So duplication of effort can be an issue. Now, I know this is something you feel strongly about and that has determined a change in direction for Cancer Support UK. Do you want to tell us all about that?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. I came to be the CEO of Cancer Support UK in 2015. So I wasn't new to the charity sector, but I was new to the cancer sector particularly. So I wanted to know, you know, if what we were doing at the time was making an effort, if it was unique, if we had some kind of USP, and actually what we were doing that was different to anybody else. So at the time I did an environmental analysis looking at charities with over £100,000 income, of which there were 333 at the time. Right. And I know that for charities under 100k income, there's, you know, probably a couple of thousands of those as well. So some of the bigger charities, we looked at what people delivered, what they were delivering in terms of services. We looked at where they were operating, whether they were regional, whether they were national, whether they were country specific. And we also looked at whether they were focusing on particular types of cancer, whether they were for adults, whether they were for children, because I really wanted to get a view of really kind of what was going on in the sector and whether there were actually any gaps. So what I found is that there is quite a lot of duplication across the charities. Certainly, many charities do research, but I appreciate that will be focused on specific areas. There's quite a lot of information and advice out there. Mm-hmm. And obviously some of it will be sort of better than others. So at the time we were doing little bits of research, you know, 60k here, but up against the sort of £630 million of income of cancer research, I thought that probably wasn't the best use of our resource.
Right.
And similarly, we were doing at the time bits of information, bits of advice, but, you know, Macmillan, again, I think are very good at doing that, so I didn't want to duplicate effort. So what remained to be done is to actually see that with the limited resources that we have, and I would categorise ourselves as a sort of small cancer charity, were there really any gaps that we could fill with the resources that we have?
Mm. Right, okay. So you've described the process by which you've refocused Cancer Support UK, very interesting. I mean, I bet there's lots of information in your little survey that we'd like to look at. But it's refocused you on what you saw to be a gap in care. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that now? What led you to your current mission and what it is exactly you're hoping to achieve?
So one of the things that I looked at was the National Cancer Strategy. And obviously that talks about one of the strategic aims being about living well with and beyond cancer. Now, time and time again in conversation with people with cancer, and obviously as a cancer charity, we engage with our beneficiaries so that they can tell us what they want. They were telling us that the diagnostics was done quite well, quite timely, the treatment was good, but almost when they came to the end of their physical treatment, we were hearing expressions like that they felt like they had fallen off a cliff when that kind of support ended. Mm. So when the physical treatment ended, emotionally there was still there was high levels of anxiety, low mood, fatigue, and those are some of the issues that hadn't been addressed. So we also looked at the National Cancer Patient Experience Survey, and some of those issues were highlighted again. So whilst most of the scores in the survey are reasonably positive, some of the lowest scores across the whole survey were around the support people received post-treatment, mm-hmm. and also the levels of communication and empathy that they've received. So that's why we really thought, there really is a gap here. Billions of pounds are spent on cancer prevention. Lots and lots of resource across the sector is invested in information, advice, and whilst people are going through treatment. But we really did feel that it was actually at the end of treatment when people felt very, very low. And bits of this research has been coming out across the last 10 years. And I think for me personally, I was quite surprised that, the advances in physical cancer treatment over the last 10 years, some of these advancements have been absolutely fantastic. But I've been reading reports from Macmillan. They did a Worried Sick report in 2006 saying mm-hmm. that, people going through cancer had, higher levels of anxiety, depression, even sort of years after the illness. Mm. But then in 2018, it seemed like actually very, very little progress had been made in this area. So that's why we came up with a programme called Cancer Coach, which hopes to address some of the problems that I've come across. So we were consistently coming up with actually... We've been through the treatment. We potentially they've been in hospital, every day or every week for months. Actually, we'd quite like to avoid another appointment at a hospital.
Right.
If people are trying to get back to work, they don't particularly want to be asking their boss for, another afternoon off a week to go for another appointment, especially if they're trying to sort of get back to normality, sort of as it were. And also what we were finding is that people were saying that there was a real postcode lottery. Some people were saying that, where they lived, there was a really, really good local group in other areas. If people were sort of more remote or more rural, there just wasn't sort of access to support. And another thing from potentially from younger people that we were finding is that support groups are absolutely fine for many people and they work. But I think when some of these groups can be unstructured, sometimes it can almost be a sort of a competition about who feels worse, who feels more ill, and potentially people who a young woman in her 30s told me that she went to a support group, but she was there with women in their 80s who were saying that they were ready to die, they were happy to die, they had a real peace with dying. But for this sort of young woman in her early 30s, mm. it absolutely was not the sort of conversation that she wanted to be having.
No.
So taking all of those elements, we designed Cancer Coach, which essentially is an 8-week programme by phone. So anybody across the UK can access it, avoids the postcode lottery. But it's a structured programme based on CBT type principles.
Just for the sake of people who don't know what CBT is, would you explain?
Oh, sorry, Robin, of course. Yeah. We all use these acronyms.
We do.
To know what they are. So CBT is cognitive behavioural therapy, and cognitive behavioural therapy is recognised by the NHS as being the most sort of effective intervention for people with low-level anxiety, depression, low mood. And also, CBT is about sort of self-management. Now, in the recovery package of the National Cancer Strategy, it really talks about, you know, helping people to manage their own illness. And so, therefore, CBT looks at goal setting, which obviously is going to be individual to the person, rather than sort of too prescriptive. So people, you know, set their own goals about what they want to achieve over, you know, a few weeks, months, years, etc. So the course is it's an 8-week course, but it's aimed at people who are coming to the end or at the end of their cancer treatment,
right.
And that means that then yes, they can, you know, dial in every week by phone. They'll be on the call with their peers, but it isn't another appointment. They can access it anywhere in the UK. Mm-hmm. It's a structured course to really help them to sort of to be more resilient and to develop tools to make themselves, you know, more resilient and recognise negative thought patterns linked to their illness. And also, so one of the key things is it's facilitated by somebody who's had cancer themselves. And there's some interesting research by Dr. Adam Gill, who focuses on patient experience of people with cancer. And one of the things that he came out from his research, actually, people with cancer talk to lots and lots of professionals, but sometimes they actually want to talk to somebody who's been there themselves. So I think that the facilitator who leads the group, having had the lived experience themselves, really adds to the kind of authenticity mm-hmm. of the course. So we're really excited about it. And one of the things is our strapline for our organisation actually is for as long as it takes, because we know that for some people, 8 weeks might be enough. For some people, you know, that they might be struggling 2 years down the line, 3 years down the line. So actually, if that's, you know, if that is somebody 2 or 3 years down the line, people can access Cancer Coach so that it genuinely is there sort of for as long as it takes for them to kind of build that resilience themselves.
Mm-hmm. So you identified two, it's the same issue, but in two different particular situations. You've talked about the problems while people are going through treatment, in communications mm-hmm. and support and all that kind of thing, empathic care, and then this particular cliff edge of the end of treatment. Now, lots of people have identified that cliff edge as a particular time when people feel hugely unsupported, and there's definitely a great gap in care there. So just to be clear, so you're focusing all the efforts of Cancer Support UK on that time after treatment ends?
We do. We do with Cancer Coach. So obviously we want to be, we have limited resources, so we have to focus it on an area that is in the greatest need, and we think that is the right area for us to be addressing. So the UCL did some research about using CBT for people with a terminal diagnosis of cancer, and actually the results proved that it wasn't particularly effective. So again, we don't concentrate on this area because we don't want to be sort of set up to fail. I mean, there's probably better interventions out there
right.
for people with a terminal diagnosis to sort of manage, you know, their emotional well-being. So we're confident that when people are coming to the end of treatment or they've just stopped their treatment, physical treatment, that is absolutely the best time for them to have this kind of an intervention. Yeah. There was a really interesting study done in Amsterdam that charted people's physical well-being against their emotional being throughout the cancer journey.
Right.
And it's really fascinating for me because when people's physical health deteriorates, and you can see that on the graph going down, mentally they're quite resilient, and I guess that would probably be the survival mode that people are in. They're feeling, you know, that they have to sort of, you know, get through this, and they're really trying to be sort of quite strong.
Yes.
Now, when treatment ends, people's physical health improves. So then on the graph, you can actually see people's physical health, you know, on the graph is in an upward trajectory, which is great. But interestingly, just at this point, when people are meant to feel better, in inverted commas, that's when really you can see the deterioration in people's mental health, and it really drops significantly. And I think people really struggle, because not only do they, I think that's when the full force of what's happened hits them, if you like, but also, yeah, I think it's really difficult, because if people have been, you know, ill for a long time, then they've finished treatment, they've been given the, you know, all clear, so to speak, then people would assume that they would feel better, and people would presumably be asking them, you must feel so much better, you must be feeling so much better than you were before. And actually, we know that isn't the case. But if somebody's been ill for a long period of time and they think that they are meant to feel better, there's almost more of a kind of guilt there, the fact that if they don't. And therefore, I think talking to people that are in the same boat, talking to your peers, with somebody who's been there themselves, rather than sort of family and friends, because sometimes actually, if you've got a really, really good social network, people don't want to, we hear words like people don't want to be a continued burden to their family and friends, and actually be honest about, I'm feeling really low. And that is the honest response about how I'm feeling when the expectation is that I should be feeling so much better.
So it would be quite interesting just to go into a bit more detail about why it is that people do experience this cliff edge. Obviously, there's the aspect of the fact they've had lots of attention, whether they liked it or not. They've had lots of attention for all throughout their treatment from lots of experts, and suddenly they got the prospect of nothing. But there's also this business of people imagining that people would go back to their lives. And I think, people who've had cancer will say, well, look, there's no back to your life at that point. Everything's fundamentally different. And this must be one of the things they struggle with, I imagine.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that the expectation to go back to how life was before just isn't an option. And actually, if you can kind of reframe your experience and try and be sort of more, use experience to be sort of more resilient going forward, then actually, something positive can come out of potentially a very negative, experience at the time. And one of the things that we have found from because our volunteers, that the facilitators for Cancer Coach have had cancer themselves, and actually it's quite empowering for them. Now, obviously, they need to be a suitable amount of time needs to have elapsed between their experience. So you're looking kind of 2, 3, 4 years down the line.
Right.
So that we protect these people's well-being. But ultimately, people have said that actually they find it quite empowering to use their experience to help others. Now, obviously, we work for charities. We ask people to volunteer their time. We ask people to donate money, but actually, what you're asking of somebody is to use their experience to help somebody else. I think that's actually quite empowering for the people who run the groups as well.
Yes, definitely. Okay, and you're saying that CBT is a useful tool for helping out there, but there, do you have a sense of what these key issues are that people are trying to deal with?
So it's low mood, anxiety, depression, fatigue, money worries, a whole host of concerns. And actually, at the beginning of the course, we ask people to complete an assessment of their own concerns.
Yes.
Now, some of these obviously naturally sort of follow a theme, but the course has to be tailored to the individual. So it isn't a sort of one-size-fits-all approach.
Right.
It's based on the concerns that people have said that they have. And obviously, if people exhibit similar concerns, they would put in a group with their peers to sort of work through those issues together. But I think ultimately, just knowing that they're not the only people that think it is actually quite a relief to them themselves, especially when there's so much pressure on them to feel better.
Yeah, it's a curious situation, isn't it? With this gap between outside expectation of your situation, possibly with little understanding of what it's like to be in that situation, and then the reality of what they're actually experiencing. And I can well see how trying to share the fact that actually things aren't great when you've just come, you've been given the all clear and sent home, it's a bit hard for other people to grasp at all.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Mm. I mean, one of the things that we do for people that are going through the treatment, who have just started their treatment, is cancer kits. Mm-hmm. So the cancer coach is the emotional support.
Right.
And the practical support we offer in terms of cancer kits. So at the moment we do 3 variations of kits. We have got cancer kits, chemo kits, and kids kits. And they contain a sort of host of things. So our chemo kit, for example, would contain warm socks for people. Obviously, people's extremities get extremely cold. They would contain ginger tea to offset the sort of nausea. A mindfulness puzzle book for all those hours spent in waiting around at appointments. Alcohol-free mouthwash to take away the sort of metallic taste in the mouth caused by chemotherapy, hand cream, lip balm, again, the dry lips and the dry hands caused by the chemotherapy. So they're all sort of really practical little box of stuff, if you like,
right.
That just people can have. So when they go in for their treatment, you know, they've got all of these things sort of to hand. And it just means that if people have one of our cancer kits while they're going through their treatment, then ultimately we've kind of reached out to them at a difficult time when their treatment ends. This information within the cancer kit about cancer coach, we hope that people will consider if they are experiencing low mood, anxiety, you know, a few weeks, months down the line, but then they get back in touch with us and then we can offer them the emotional support via the cancer coach program.
Oh, I see. And how are people generally finding you?
So we work with sort of other organisations, so we have the sort of informal signposting. Actually, the internet seems to be quite good. So people who receive cancer kits, a lot of the time that they'll post it on Facebook or Twitter and say, oh, I've just received this fantastic little cancer kit from Cancer Support UK, which then gets retweeted. And obviously, because the cancer community on social media is quite active,
yes.
People generally sort of find us like that, and that's good, and I'm really pleased about that, because A, it's organic, we're not paying for that, and it means that it's kind of peer-to-peer recommendations. And obviously, you know, it's great for me when people say that they really, really appreciate receiving this kit. Somebody else sees that, they get the kit, they think it's great, and again, they sort of recommend it, whether that's on social media or verbally, but that's how the cancer kits certainly have been sort of people find out about them at the moment. I mean, both the cancer kits and the cancer coach, information about both is on our website.
Okay.
And people can order a cancer kit for themselves or for a loved one on the Cancer Support UK website, and also sign up for cancer coach or even sign up to be a cancer coach volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
On the website. So all of the information is on our website, which is www.cancersupportuk.org.
Yeah. Okay, great. So I'm interested in whether this is an issue that's kind of just spread across the country, or are you finding there are places where it's known to be more prevalent than others?
It seems to be evenly spread.
Hmm.
It seems to be evenly spread. And I think, like a lot of services, if you've got a really good active signpost in the region, then by definition, you know, you'll have more sort of referrals from that area. But both the cancer kits and the cancer coach inquiry seem to be come from sort of, you know, across the UK. We haven't done any work in sort of doing any real analysis as yet, so I couldn't say for sure. But at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any kind of regionalised bias.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On your website, you report that like 78% of cancer patients in the UK, they're still reporting the fact that they've got unmet emotional needs. Now, that's like 4 out of 5 people, you know, that's amazing. And and I imagine the needs of the other 20% were maybe not generally being met by the NHS, but probably by charities like yours. Or other outside providers. Mm-hmm. So this is a massive figure, and it underlines there's the kind of care desert, if you like, that is our hospital system. This is something I've always taken a great interest in because, of course, I've had a lot to do with the hospital system myself, and it's a stark reality. And many people have a kind of stiff upper lip approach, but they don't expect that from the hospital, mm-hmm. and they don't get it, and so therefore they're satisfied. But for others, they're devastated mm-hmm. by actually what's going on, you know, when they find themselves at their most vulnerable and the most need of support, and they get this very cold, mechanical response to their situation where how they mm-hmm. feel about it is, mm-hmm. is really nothing to do with it. So, you know, from our point of view at Yes to Life, the person's well-being, how they are psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, is a huge part of their overall well-being. And so to ignore it is like, well, you're not really helping them to get better. So I just wondered how you see all that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that when, you know, doctors, oncologists, nurses with the best will in the world are seeing hundreds, potentially thousands of patients every year, you know, there is that deep element of sort of compassion fatigue that you know, is likely to come in. And I don't know whether the NHS is addressing that, but certainly a personal experience to me, wasn't through my charity, mm-hmm. A member of my family had cancer. And right. when they were told in the hospital that they had cancer, it was when, my mum actually, when she was just getting dressed, behind the screen, putting her top on, and then just told, oh, yes, you know, it is cancer. You know, really, really sort of...
matter of fact.
In a really sort of relaxed manner. And, yeah, and I thought, actually, you know, you might have said that to sort of thousands of people, but that's the first time my nurse ever had that said to her. And actually, you know, just do her the decency to have her sit down and actually look her in the face and break this news to her. In a way that just didn't sound sort of so flippant, I guess. You know, but and I think it's just these tiny, you know, tweaks in kind of communication that people would appreciate. You know, and things like that do make a big difference to people, obviously, when they go through the experience. You know, and that is basic communication skills. When you talk to somebody, you talk to them to their face and you ask them to sit down rather than sort of say it, you know, through a curtain when somebody's got their jumper halfway over their head, you know. So just little things like that. But I agree, you know, it's that kind of compassion fatigue, and potentially people forget the importance that it's going to have on an individual when they break that kind of news to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, from my perspective, it's a huge systemic problem which has been there in medicine, you know, forever. You know, and it's not just in the UK. Mm-hmm. It's not like the NHS is particularly bad. It happens everywhere on the planet, it seems, the same thing. It's a very curious state of affairs, really, but that's the way it is. And the people who are working in it, I think, are damaged by it. And the people who are treated by mm-hmm. it are damaged by it. You know, lack of empathy and things is just, well, empathy is part of being human, basically. And so it's being mm-hmm. inhuman. Mm-hmm. not to be empathic about people who are in a very desperate situation. So I'm dead keen, of course, that this should actually change in the hospital system. It's a huge task, but I'm very pleased. I'm actually going to a conference in June, which is devoted to the complexities and challenges of doctor-patient communication, particularly in this case around mm-hmm. Patients taking initiative with doing anything to help themselves. So that would be any kind of integrative treatment or any kind of dietary intervention, anything like that. And it's the first time I've heard of any conference like this, but
that sounds fantastic. And
yeah, a lot of people these days do want to do everything they can to help themselves, and the conversations around that tend to be very bad quite often. And we're actually just collecting some of these up, because it's just like, well, I think it's a totally unacknowledged problem. It's not understood by the public that's what's going on. People only find out when they first bring the subject up because they've got cancer. I don't think the doctors themselves think there's anything wrong either. So it just needs to be, you know, had a look at. We need to just say, well, look, this really is a problem. You know, governments have been saying there are problems in this area for a long time. As you know, you've done the research. And it's got to be much more in the public eye, I think, so we can actually begin to change it.
Yeah, you're right. And I think the investment actually needs to be there. So it's one of the new strategic aims of the cancer strategy. One of them is living well with and beyond cancer.
Right.
But... you know, but my thinking is that actually hardly any resource has been invested in this area. So it appears that some of the strategic aims are more equal, even though they're supposed to be equal. Some of them certainly seem to be more equal than others in terms of the investment that they're getting. So I think from a policy sort of perspective, we're not a campaign charity, and we don't sort of work on policy, but certainly organisations that do really need to be pushing that this adequate investment into these strategic areas that they themselves have identified as really, really important within the sort of cancer journey, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the moment, there you are, a small charity, as you've described yourself, trying to pick up the tab for what is essentially a huge gulf in cancer care. To think that cancer ends the day that people are sent home, of course, is clearly not correct.
Yeah, there's a term about sort of scanxiety that I've heard a couple of times. So even if people, you know, aren't immediately sort of having feelings of low mood, anxiety, depression, obviously when people have to go back for their scans, if that's annually or 5 years, of course there's a heightened level of anxiety at that time.
Yeah.
And again, where do people go to have that sort of psychological support and emotional support at that time? So again, going back to Cancer Coach, even if it was sort of 4 or 5 years down the line, if people want to access it, then they can. So the fact that it's always there, I think, is quite nice, just to know that sort of support is there, and people will absolutely know how they are feeling because the people that they are talking to will have been experiencing these things themselves.
Mm-hmm. So scanxiety, as you described it, is kind of, it's like a peak, if you like, in a graph which doesn't go down to zero in between for most people, unfortunately, because, of course, the concern about cancer returning is something that people live with ever more.
So. Yes, you're right, and you know, sometimes the full force of the event or the episode might not hit people sort of 5 years down the line. So by that point they'd be sort of well out of the sort of NHS system, but obviously they can reconnect back into those sort of support networks with charities like ours, with charities like yours. So yeah, I think you're right. I think that charities are playing a real vital role, especially in the sort of emotional support capacity.
Mm. But overall, do you feel that's that's how it should be, or do you think actually this is the NHS should be accommodating all of this?
I think a bit of both. I mean, I think at the moment, you know, even somebody who wants to access CBT therapies can be on a waiting list for a few months on the NHS. I think actually with mental health on the agenda, you know, there's just not enough money being put into sort of mental health overall, regardless of whether it's specific to cancer. But
sure.
I think that there's almost ways that we can work together. One of the interventions that I looked at when I was devising Cancer Coach is a project that MIND did, the mental health charity. They did a peer support programme over a few weeks for people with sort of low-level mental health problems. And actually, that was really effective. All of the outcomes that they were measuring against were came out as positive. And actually, that got commissioned by the NHS. That was sort of, I think that was about sort of 2 or 3 years ago. So I think in that respect, you know, a charity, in this case MIND, has come up with a really good service that's scalable and you can replicate it. They've obviously sort of, you know, given the evidence, the NHS, and said, look, we can run this for you if you sort of want to commission the service. And it seems to have worked in that context. So I think that's certainly something that we would look to explore, you know, within the next few months.
Right. OK, so the charities are like pioneering new approaches, building the case for them, and then selling the idea to the NHS as something that could be part of the health service.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. OK. We're coming towards the end, Gemma. Can I ask you just to give us your ideas about where you're heading as a charity, where you'd like to see Cancer Support UK in a few years' time?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's something that we have been considering. I think personally, because I am so confident that Camp the Coach is a really, really good initiative, and it really meets an unmet need. I think this is the area that we would like to continue to focus on. And also because the Camp the Kits have received such positive feedback, we'd like to continue with those, and which is the sort of practical support. I think for me, I personally like organisations with a singleness of purpose. You know, rather than being a sort of jack of all trades and trying to do lots of different right. initiatives and lots of different projects, I think the way I see the organisation going is that the Cancer Coach initiative is scalable. So at the moment we have a generic course for anybody over the age of 18, but there's no reason going forwards that we can have a sort of a young adults group for parents of children with cancer. A men's group, a young women's group, a teenage group, you know. So it's variations on the theme yes. rather than sort of really trying to sort of design some totally new initiatives. And similarly with the Cancer Kit, at the moment we have got three different kits, and I see potentially sort of variations on their theme. We could have four or five, six versions. We could make the kits more substantial. But ultimately, I just think, you know, I know that we're in a real niche place. Other people are doing really good work around research. Other charities are doing really good work around information and advice. So I think, you know, we will continue to do what we do and just do really, really well.
Mm. Right, so we're going to wrap it up there.
Thanks very much for talking to us today, Gemma. That's been really interesting. Fantastic work addressing one of the biggest problems in healthcare worldwide is this need for psychological and emotional support. So I'm delighted to have met you the other day at a conference, and I thank you very much for coming on today to tell us all about your work at Cancer Support UK.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. I've really enjoyed having the opportunity to tell you about it. And likewise, you know, it's been great to meet you and hear what you're doing. So I look forward to a continued relationship going into the future.
Definitely. Thank you, Gemma.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks. Bye.
You can find full details of Cancer Support UK and other resources mentioned by Gemma on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. On the homepage, click the show logo. Another quick reminder that we have a great event coming up in Manchester on the 27th of April, that's just next month, a Cancer Wellness Day. Look either on the Yes to Life Facebook page or under events on the Yes to Life website, again that's yestolife.org.uk, for details and for booking. Thanks again for listening today. If you enjoyed the show, be aware there's an amazing back catalogue of nearly 200 Yes to Life shows available on Listen on Demand on UK Health Radio. I look forward to bringing you another Yes to Life show and another inspiring guest next week. Goodbye.